Hi, and welcome to today's meeting of Book Hoarders Anonymous. Let's all begin by introducing ourselves.
Hi, I'm Shannon, and I'm a book hoarder.
Hi, Shannon.
Hi, I'm Erin, and I'm a book hoarder.
Hi, Erin.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Book Hoarders Anonymous, episode 40. Really and truly this time. Yay! I'm Erin.
And I'm Shannon.
And we're going to talk about books we've read and the book of the month, or, well, of the podcast this time, and celebrate being over the hill.
Yes.
Podcast. And also, an author has celebrated, for once, this is not about author's death, this is about author's birth. There is an author who has celebrated a very special birthday, and we'll talk about that later on in the podcast.
Yes, it's very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll also be introducing a new podcast feature, so stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, let's see. Let me start out with talking about what I read this month. I went through a huge reading slump. Then I forced myself to come out of it because I had book club a couple of weeks ago. And for book club, we read Look Homeward, Angel by Thomas Wolfe. Wolfe was from North Carolina, and Look Homeward, Angel was a 25-hour semi-autobiographical novel that he wrote when he was 28. Or 27 or 28, and I was very impressed by the novel, while at the same time being horrifically bored.
I can relate to that.
I'll talk about
that a little later.
Yeah, yes. I think I slept through large portions of the book and did not miss much. And that's one way of saying that it was horrifically overlong. I mean, I think it was at least 300 pages longer than it needed to be.
Wow. Yeah.
But at the same time, I thought that it was very... His facility with language was fantastic. It was a very sensual novel. It was almost as if you could smell and taste and see the landscape around you, which very few authors, in my opinion... Taylor Caldwell does that well. But I know a very few authors who can really make the landscape just sort of jump out at you. The landscape and the people jump out at you and make them feel real. And so Wolfe did that. But, you know, the novel I'm just really ambivalent about because it was just so overlong. And I went to book club, and I guess a lot of people either hated or did not read the book because there were only three of us there.
But you did your due diligence.
I read the book. I did. I finished it. Like I said, I don't know that I read through all of the parts that I slept through, but I tried.
Yeah.
And that's about all I can say for that. I do think that it was, I mean, it was worth reading at least once, but it's not one of those things that I'm going to go back and reread like, wow, it's my timeless favorite. It is a classic. A lot of people read it in high school, which makes sense because it's kind of like somebody feels like he doesn't fit in the town he lives in. Mm-hmm. He's kind of angsty and all this kind of stuff. So I get that. And maybe if I'd read it when I was a teenager, I could have related to more of that angst. But I don't think I would have been patient enough. Because like I said, it's a 25, 26-hour audio read.
Yeah.
Very, very long.
That's okay. Our next month's book is like a 37-hour audio book. So you get to do this again.
I know. Woohoo! So after Look Homeward, Angel, I was keen to read short, kind of short books. And I did. I read a few. One of them was called Voices in the Evening by Natalia Ginsburg. And, well, I downloaded it and started reading it because it was read by Laura Generelli, who is one of the Bard narrators that I have this enormous crush on. I think she can read almost anything, kind of like I feel about Erin Jones. But she's been reading, you know, Laura Generelli's been reading stuff since the 70s and 80s. And this book... was by an author who was writing in the 40s through the 60s, I guess. And she is kind of interesting. She is an Italian Jew who wrote a lot about the fascism and the conflict surrounding World War II in Italy. And her writing style reminds me a lot of Ernest Hemingway. I really did like the book. I was surprised because it's kind of literary, you know, and it's just, it's kind of you know, lofty in a sense. But the style's very terse and simple, kind of like Hemingway. And it moves right along. It's only about, I don't know, maybe a couple hundred pages. And I got through it pretty quickly. Basically, it's about this village of people. And it's narrated primarily from the point of view of one of the women who lives in the village. And the village is dominated by a factory. I think it makes cloth or something. And how over time, you know, it's kind of like before World War II and then what happens after World War II. Over time, the factory is rendered kind of obsolete and people start moving away. And the guy who owns the factory, I think he sells it or something. All of this to state that the woman in the book, Elsa, is kind of conflicted about what she wants to do. Like, does she want to stay or does she want to go? And I think she decides that towards the end, it feels like she's going to move on with her life and kind of leave as well. So it kind of talks about the movement of people from small town to big city life and how that sped up and how the war, to some extent, was responsible for it. I did enjoy it. I'm not quite sure why it was called Voices of the Evening or In the Evening or whatever it is, but I enjoyed finding that new author. And I may try to find some of her other books. I mean, it's kind of that writing style that just kind of moves along and takes you with it. And it was good. It didn't dwell too. I mean, you know, the Thomas Wolfe, my God, it was just ridiculous. Dwelt on things for pages. And this just didn't do that. And it was a good thing to read after that 25-hour slog because it just, you know, it was just to whiz right through. Let's see. What else did I read? I am trying to find what I did with my books. Let's see. Okay. I'll edit this part out. Let's see. So another thing I read was another long book. It was called The Luck of Waymock by Daniel Peters. And I've heard things about this author's work before. I think he was an archaeologist turned author. and I had never read a book by him. And this was really fascinating. It was also a little bit depressing at the end. It was about this guy who, it was about the Toltecs before the Spanish invaded in 1520 or whenever it was. And it was about the downfall of the Toltecs predominantly because of their war against each other. You know, they were all divided into these warring factions, which was perfect when the Spanish strolled in and just took everything over and brought their diseases and strange guns and hornless deer, which was interesting to describe the horses, and small lions, which was how they thought of the dogs. But the book did not primarily concern the invasion. That happened like at the end. It primarily concerned this guy named, well, Waymock, or as voiceover calls him, Humac. and he was born during this time of famine, and it was like this really ill-omened birth. And he was also like a really, really ugly baby, apparently. And his parents read all the omens, and they had them all read to them or whatever, and he was supposed to have just terrible luck throughout his life. I mean, he was a bad luck kid, basically. And, you know, in our day and age, we would say, you know, if you're poor and downtrodden and somewhat disenfranchised, and that's going to be the luck you'll have through life. And in his case, it was the omens are all bad surrounding your birth, so that's your luck, you know. But it was interesting because he went through the book trying to work against that and make his life turn out really well, which it did up to a point. And then, like, Montezuma started not liking him, and the Spanish invaded, and the whole thing just went to pieces. And the Toltecs were overrun and the Spanish took over, which was kind of sad and depressing. And it went through several generations of his family. So the last generation of his family, his great-grandchildren and grandchildren, escaped and, you know, fled into the hills. And you get the idea that they survived to carry on whatever, you know, knowledge and wisdom the Toltecs had. So in that way, I guess you could look at it positively, but it ended in a kind of depressing way, and it ended with the epidemic of the chicken pox that they brought and killed like 60,000 people in 60 days, which was horrible. But I really did enjoy it. It was one of those books where I'm interested in that period of history, so that helped. And the only problem that I found with the book was everyone's name sounded kind of alike. I guess if I was reading it in Braille, it would have been different because they are spelled different, but with all these like strange blends of consonants and, mm-hmm. you know, they have like this TL sound that we don't have and things end in weird, you know, like words end kind of weirdly and they all have kind of similar endings. All the names to me kind of ran together and you're like, who is this person again? Which I guess is why the author has like this name index and place index in the beginning of the book. But to those of us reading in audio, I kept having to go to that heading and kind of skip through seconds at a time to try and find the name I was looking for. And that got kind of mm-hmm. cumbersome after a while. But I thought the book was good, and it was one of those like epic historical novels. So it took a long time to read. And I have to say, I read it in three big pushes. Like, I guess in early March, I read a big swath of it. And then a couple weeks later, I read another third of it. And a couple weeks later, I read another third. And that was the way I got through it. But for those of you who like really dramatic sort of historical epic novels, it's a really good read. Read by a narrator that I had not heard before, Dana Bate. He sounded an awful lot like Dennis Bateman, so I'm wondering if it's just
they're
him,
related, yeah.
Or they're related, and you know he had a different name or something. But it was good. I enjoyed that. And the final book I'll mention before this ramble fest comes to an end is Alice by Christina Henry. And for some reason, lately on Bard, there have been a couple books put up about alternative Alice in Wonderlands. And this was one of them. I don't know if it was related to the movie or not. It was written in 2015. The movie came out about that same time, if I recall. And the idea behind the book and the movie is kind of similar, but like I said, I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know what it's like at all. In the book, Alice is in an insane asylum because she was thought crazy. And it's like 10 years after her adventure in Wonderland, and she's now 26 instead of 16. Mm-hmm. Which in the real book, Alice in Wonderland, she's like 6. But, you know, in this alternative fantasy,
sure.
She's older than that when she goes into Wonderland. And so she's in an insane asylum because everyone thinks that she's crazy because she keeps talking about rabbits and tea parties and cake and all this stuff. And when she's 26, the insane asylum catches on fire, burns down. I'm not really spoiling anything because that happens in the first chapter. She escapes, again, first chapter, and she finds out that Wonderland is really a real place.
Of course.
And it was very, very dark. This was not like Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, like you would think. She goes back to Wonderland and all this other stuff happens. And her adventure in Wonderland that she had before the book all started was very, you get to know a little bit about what happened to her. It was very, I mean, you know, she was raped and all this stuff. It was very violent. Yeah, it was not what you would think. That said, I thought the book was pretty cool. Like the caterpillar and the walrus and the white rabbit, they were real people, but they were like street gang thugs. It was kind of interesting.
Huh.
And so they were in the Cheshire Cat was actually a person named Cheshire, and there was some magic in it. But really these were like heads of rival street gangs and they owned parts of the city, and that's how it played out. So her task was to find the Vorpal sword to kill the Jabberwock. It ended in uh-huh. but she had to go through all these street gang thug territories in order to try and find it. And it was fun. I really enjoyed reading that. I read that a few days ago. Very dark and violent, like I said, but it was an interesting take on Wonderland, which made me ask the game master the other night in my role-playing game, since we were doing a one-night game because one of our players was gone, whether we could do a Wonderland setting, and that was fun.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, all because of that book. And we did, and we came out alive. So,
good.
Okay. Anyway, so now you get to tell me all about your books that you read.
Okay. I read a lot. I did not have a reading slump this past month. Mm-hmm. I read a variety of different things. A lot of it, like, what happened between this last month and this is that I discovered a new podcast called Overdue, mm-hmm. which I highly recommend. It's like their tagline is that it's a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read, mm-hmm. and so it's like they're it's a weekly podcast, so they're not like us where they do once a month and then they're two guys that. and they each read like whatever, like a book, and then they talk about it. And so I was listening to all the episodes of the books that I had read, and then I was kind of going through and trying to find ones that I had not, and you know, that mm-hmm. that it would be interested in. Mm-hmm. So because of that podcast, I read The Reader by Bernard Schlink, which is not a book I would have picked out ordinarily, but it was really, it was about a young man who, when he's 15, he meets this woman, and she's kind of like his first love, his first like foray into grown up sex, and she's like quite a bit older than he is, and you know, it's they have an interesting time together, and then they both kind of go their separate ways, and then a few years later, he is in law school, and he ends up sitting in on this trial where he meets her again, and she has been charged with like being a Nazi war criminal.
Wow.
And like it's just like it raised some interesting questions, and because it was like set in the 1960s or whatever, so you know, it like, so when, obviously when he met her, when he was like 15, it would have been like just after the war was over. And then, mm-hmm. you know, they, but like, it's sort of like the question became like, could he, you know, how does he deal with the fact that this woman that he was in love with, you know, was a Nazi.
Oh, right.
And it really humanizes her. And like she's a really interesting character, and it is very short. It's like maybe a 4-hour long audiobook, and wow. I got it through Audible. I think that that NLS did do it, but they haven't digitized it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really good. I ended up reading for the Seattle book club that I go to every other month with my colleague at the library where I work. We read The Good Earth by Pearl Buck, which I had read part of in high school and never finished.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, you were talking a little bit earlier about books that are like beautifully written, like mm-hmm. gorgeous prose and, but still aren't really all that. I mean, I can't say it wasn't engaging. It was very engaging. I just didn't like the characters. I mean, I like, you know, it's about, you know, for those of you that haven't read it in high school either, you know, it's about this Chinese guy before Mao shows up. And he is like a peasant farmer. And it's kind of all about his life, starting from when he marries the wife that his dad picks out for him, to like he becomes very prosperous. Like he starts out very poor, and then he gets very prosperous, and then like so prosperous, in fact, that in the end, like, you know, he's trying to tell his sons how important the land is because that's how they've earned their livelihood, and they're just like, sure, dad, whatever. spoilers for an 80-year-old book.
Yeah.
And I really thought that like it was fascinating because the writing has this very epic kind of biblical feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like it really did feel like I was reading a parable at points. And like there were things that I'm not sure I would have noticed as a teenager. Like he treats his wife like crap. I mean, he really does. And that was the point at which he lost me as a reader, because like he does something to her at one point in the book where that like I just couldn't forgive him for. And like, you know, when he becomes so rich and prosperous and he's just kind of ashamed of her, and it's like, you know, you would not be where you are today without this woman. Mm-hmm. Making sure everything's running smoothly, so you know, be a little grateful. But he never was. And so it was a really good, like, I'm I don't think I want to read the rest of the trilogy about his sons because they were pretty horrible humans as well. But I was glad I read that first book. And we had a really good book club discussion about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've read a few other really good romances and things like that, because that's what I do. I want to talk about one that I read called Dead Ringer by Sam Schooler and Heidi Belleau. It's B-E-L-L-E-A-U. It's about the... I mention it because one of the characters has, he's kind of a shut-in, and he's got, mm-hmm. like juvenile onset arthritis, so it means he's in chronic pain, and, he has this caregiver who's really the antagonist of the piece, and the other guy, it's a male-male romance, and the other guy is the grandson of this, this old-fashioned, silver screen era movie celebrity, sort of, who is modeled on James Dean, but, isn't James Dean, because obviously they, they can't do that. And so they kind of, and they end up meeting, and it was, they both kind of have to, the guy who's the grandson of the celebrity kind of ends up realizing that a lot of his ideas about his grandfather's life are just plain wrong. And, the other guy kind of has to learn it doesn't have to be a shut-in, a lot of the things that have kept him back have been, things that people have said, you're a disabled person and, you're going to need so much help. You can't possibly live on your own, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And as people that are disabled ourselves, I felt like I really could relate to that. It was really well done. I thought that, so many times I read romances featuring disabled characters, and they either have to downplay it, this is a thing to be overcome. At the end, he's going to get hit on the head, and all of a sudden his blindness will go away.
Yeah.
Or it's or they don't get featured at all. The disabled characters are the ones that you just sort of sit there and feel sorry for. So it was just really nice to read something that I felt was that realistically handled it well.
Mm-hmm.
So I would definitely recommend that. And then the last book I'll talk about was a book called Fairy Blood by Angela Corotti. I don't think I talked about that last time.
Mm-mm.
I read it. It was an urban fantasy book set in Seattle, which was why I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of urban fantasy that I like because, the plot is fairly simple. The main character figures out that she's got fairy blood, hence the title. And, ends up having all these adventures where she has to deal with that. And she, she runs into, this group of people that kind of become her sidekicks along the way. And it just does a lot of things really well. This girl starts out with friends, and she gets to keep them. She's not a snarky loner, which was something that I really appreciated. And, there was a romance, but, there was not an obnoxious love triangle. There was some guy that she was sort of drawn to, but she could, that was not the romantic lead. And she's like, no, he's bad news. Mm-hmm. So I really liked that. And it was very, very classic urban fantasy, Charles DeLint and Emma Bull and things like that. It really made me think of those books. And that's the kind of urban fantasy I prefer. So another book that really worked for me.
Oh, fun. Well, it sounds like you had a good reading.
I did.
month. And this brings us into our news items for the week, because speaking of reading, the 24-hour readathon is coming up next weekend, next Saturday.
Yeah, so hopefully by the time we get this out, you will still have time to sign up for it.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get this out in a couple of days. So you should have time to sign up for it before the readathon actually happens. And if you don't know what the readathon is, it's been going on for several years now. You can find it at 24hourreadathon.com. And basically, that's what it says. You read for 24 hours straight. That's the goal. I can already tell you I will not be reading for 24 hours straight because I don't want to go to church on Sunday and pass out in the choir loft.
I don't know if anybody ever actually does.
I don't know if anyone actually does that, but it's fun to, you know, devote a Saturday to reading. My husband says, why is this different? Because that's all you ever do anyway on weekends. And my answer to him is it's different because now there's a social component involved.
Yes.
You can read and talk about what you're reading on Twitter or Facebook. Keep your own reading log of what you read and also challenge each other on Twitter or Facebook to read more or read something you haven't read before. There are a lot of different challenges that they offer. I think one every hour, and you can participate in as many as you want. A lot of people really gear up. There are some people that start planning weeks and weeks ahead what they're going to read and even what they're going to eat and what they're going to snack on, and they buy all their stuff. It's like preparing for this some kind of like disaster survival or something. I don't know. It's really funny the lengths that some people go to prepare for this thing and the devotion they have to it. I myself don't know what I'm going to read yet. I think I have kind of an idea, but and I'll probably plan it out a few days before. And another thing to mention is that you may win a prize, because if you participate, your name is entered into a drawing for prizes that are given away. Many of these prizes are, you know, books by authors that are just starting out, or gift cards, or, you know, other fun stuff. In the first readathon that I participated in, I actually won a prize. So it does happen. It does happen. I won a hard copy book by an author whose name I can't remember. I do remember that the book is called Blood Will Out. It is a true crime novel. It was a true crime. I think it's nonfiction. It was really good from what I remember. Walter somebody. I'm going to have to figure out what that is and find it for the show notes, the name of the author, because I can't remember. I do know that the book is still sitting on my bookshelf, and I read it a couple of years ago when I won it, and don't remember much about it other than it was good. People are now starting to encourage others to participate in the readathon over Twitter. Shayna Reeds has posted her top 10 reasons for participating in the readathon, and they include the following. Of course, reading is fun. She talked about also the fact that you can win a prize if you participate. And talked about challenging one another, that that's also a good way to participate. The challenges are sometimes really innovative and creative and motivate everyone to read different things. And the last one, I do know that number 10 that she posted was, and of course the snacks, how could I forget those?
Exactly.
So have you participated in one before?
I have. I did. You know, I found that when I remember to sign up on the website, it works out for me better, mm-hmm. because then I'm more motivated to do it.
Right.
Whereas, like, you know, if I just like, oh, well, it's the readathon, I'll read whenever I want to. What ends up happening is that I get distracted by other things, and then suddenly it's 10 o'clock and I haven't touched a book, and then it gets later and later and I get frustrated that I haven't. And so, but like but the readathon website, like there's always new posts every hour. And, you know, like I remember when I did it, when I officially signed up to do it, it was fun. I read the website every hour, and then I was like, Erin, what a prize.
Yeah. That really surprised me.
Did you see that you won a prize, Erin?
I was like, what the hell is she talking about? Excuse me. But I hadn't seen. And so I went there. I was like, wow, I won a prize. And I didn't even know. And by that point, you know, I think it may have been the next day, and I hadn't slept well the night before because, of course, I was reading until like 2 o'clock in the morning, and was kind of not with it. And then I read my Twitter timeline and I'm like, oh, I've won a prize. I better go look at that.
And I planned it. The thing that I did this year is I planned it better. I decided I'm taking off that Friday before,
uh-huh.
so that I can get all my snacks in order. I'll probably go down to the grocery store and pick some out. And then I will also like sleep in late that morning so that I can have plenty of sleep for, so I can wake up because I'm on Pacific time and it starts at like 8 o'clock Eastern time, which is
5 o'clock your time. Oh my God.
And I, what happened the last time I did this was that I woke up at 5 a.m. and I was like, I'm up, I'm ready to read some books. And then I was like, I took my book back to bed with me.
Uh-oh.
And I fell asleep. And I was like, I'm just going to count that because...
Of course.
By the time I woke up later and was ready to do it, you know, I was like... you know, pretty motivated, but 5 a.m. is rough.
That is hard. That is definitely hard. Now, I don't know if anyone is going to be reading any poetry during the readathon, but it is National Poetry Month this April. And so I have a couple of articles about that. Specifically, Michigan State University uses National Poetry Month as an excuse to have a poetry festival. And every Wednesday they in April, well, maybe it's the first, second, and third Wednesdays in April, they have an author come to the university and read some of their poetry and talk about it. This year they had authors that I had never heard of come. And also, I'm not into poetry, so those of you who like poetry may know more about it than I do. So I put the article in the show notes that talks about the authors, and you can just see whether you had heard of them or not. The authors read their poetry, and somehow there's a discussion around the poetry that they're featuring. So that's happening this year, and I think they did the festival last year and had great success with it, so they're doing another one this year. I also have an article in the show notes from Book Riot about how to read poetry and enjoy it if you're not into poetry. I'm one of those people who isn't. I don't know why, but I think part of it is I like poetry if I can actually feel it on the page. It's like a Braille thing. If I can feel it on the page and feel the lengths of the lines and actually read it and have the experience of doing it, it's much more interesting to me than either if I'm reading it one line at a time on the Braille display or if I'm reading it in audio, which is basically someone else's voice interpreting it and reading it for me. And I just don't seem to really enjoy it or get much out of it. And I feel like it's... I should, you know, I like to read stories and I like to read all these other media. Even nonfiction is really good if it's well written and engaging, but I just can't get into poetry. I have this block somehow, and I don't know whether it's a visual thing or an audio thing. I don't know. What do you think? Are you a poetry person?
I'm with you. I think that for me, it does work better if I can feel the lines. Reading poetry in audio, I mean, like, it's one thing if you have somebody reciting poetry, like, you know, going to, like, a poetry event and, like, mm-hmm. having people read out their work. That's one thing. But, like, an audio book of poetry that without that live audience component is just not working for me.
Yeah, it doesn't work for me either. And I've tried reading it on Kindle and, like, voiceover reading poetry. Oh my God, just forget it.
Either.
Just forget it. And there is and I've often found that even if I read it in Braille, there are some books that they will, in the UK, they have an end of line indicator. And so when they write poetry in books, they will use that line indicator and then a space and then move on to the next line. And so you don't get the lines and it looks like a big paragraph, and that takes away something of it.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
And there are even situations in the U.S. where the books will, instead of an end-of-line indicator, they'll have several spaces between the end mm-hmm. of one line and the beginning of another, instead of actually a carriage return and a new line. And that, to me, also takes away something from it. I don't know. I have the image of a poem in my head as lines, and it takes away the meter and the structure
yeah.
of the poem.
Yeah.
So to me, that's very, it's dependent on that. And so if I'm going to enjoy poetry, it's got to be in a Braille book, which of course are hard to find. Speaking of poetry, there is a poem that was featured in the New Yorker about Chinese food that people hate. And this is a typical example of people not really reading or paying attention, but letting their emotional responses get the better of them. So this guy wrote a poem and put it in the New Yorker, and he's talking all about the different kinds of Chinese food and how are we supposed to keep track of all the different things when it's like Szechuan and General So and Cantonese and Lo Mein and Chop Suey and whatever all the provinces in China are, Hunan, you know, all that. And what's the difference? And I don't get it. And how do people keep track of it? And basically, that's what the poem is all about. He's making fun of the different types of food and the people who are snobbish enough to keep track of all of that. And to him, it's just Chinese food. People were reading the poem, and they thought that he thought that Chinese people were, I don't know, like obnoxious, or there were too many different kinds of Chinese people, or something. I don't know. They interpreted it as he was saying something racist about the people in China, when really he was saying something about the food in America that's come out of Chinese food ideas. So I kind of sort of didn't get that, but I felt like since it was National Poetry Month, I had to put a story about poetry interpretation in the news items, and that was the one that to me seemed the most weird and crazy and not dry and literary. So that's yes. The one that got in there. I don't know. And speaking of international things, there is a writer in Angola who wants more local, well, Angolan literature included in schools, specifically children's literature, to teach children about, you know, Angola authors and heritage. And the author's name is Zulini Bumba, and she has spoken at various events to try and get teachers and educators to include more books in their classes by Angolan authors, and specifically children, which I thought was interesting. Children's literature written by children from Angola, instead of focusing more on foreign literature, you know, written by Europeans and Asians and folks in other countries. And I never thought
that's fair.
I never thought about that before. Because, I mean, like in the U.S., we have an overabundance of literature written by American authors, you know, white male Americans. And, you know, there isn't really a lot written by folks from other countries. We have a lot of British literature that we consider classics that we encourage our high schoolers to read. But really, aside from this Anglo-American preference, we really don't read much written by Asians and Africans in schools. We should listen to what all these people are saying about inclusion. I think that's very important.
I think so, too.
Speaking of American authors, of course, there are a lot of wonderful, fantastic authors like Beverly Cleary.
Like Beverly, who wrote children's books
that we have read. Great segue there. We've all read some Beverly Cleary. She's written over 40 children's books in her lifetime, and she turned 100 on April 12th of this year. She decided when she was about 30 years old, and it was, I guess, during World War II, when she was a part-time librarian, that she wanted to write books. And we all know about her character, Ramona. Beverly Cleary says that Ramona started out as a really minor character in her first children's book, Henry Huggins, which I have read, and then grew into a major character with her own series. She was inspired to write the character based on a girl that she knew growing up in her neighborhood, who was very mischievous and got into troubles like buying a pound of butter at the grocery store and eating it on the way home. Ew!
Ew!
But that was the kind of thing that, you know, those were the kinds of things. I don't think Ramona actually did that in the books, but, you know, I could see it because she was very mischievous and inspired a lot of authors down the road. Beverly Cleary's books became, you know, a lot of future authors became fans of her books when they were kids. The Diary of a Wimpy Kid. I don't remember who wrote that, but I think he was a fan of Beverly Cleary. And Cleary wrote books based on what she thought kids would want to read about. A typical example is when she was stuck an idea for a book, she asked her son what he wanted to read about, and he said motorcycles. So she wrote The Mouse and the Motorcycle, which I read and laughed my way through. I think I read it in high school, actually. And it's about a mouse, and he meets up with this kid in a hotel, and this kid has a toy motorcycle, and the mouse uses that toy motorcycle to, like, confiscate some aspirin because the kid was sick. And it was so cute. and funny, and I laughed my way through it, and the sequel. I don't remember what it was called, but featuring Ralph S. Mouse and his motorcycle. So that was a birthday celebration. Instead of celebrating an author's death, we celebrate an author's birth this month.
Yay.
For a change. And also for a change, we have two things. We have one listener mail, and then another change we'll talk about after we talk about this month's homework.
Yep. Let's do the listener mail. That's a good segue.
We will, because the listener mail focuses on the book American Housewife by Helen Ellis that was our homework for this month. And it was a book of short stories that were very dark and satirical about what it says about housewives in the U.S. in current day America. And Christina got in touch with us and she said, well, I hate to be critical, but I really did not like this book. And being critical is all what this podcast was about.
Yes.
And especially since I hated this book and I was the one who picked it. And I am the first to admit that it was a really crappy thing to pick and to read.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that I hated it, but would I read it again? No. It was dark. I felt like she had some good ideas, but either there wasn't enough time to develop them, or they were like, or like she spent too much time with them. It like sort of depended on the story. My favorite piece was the one with the, and I don't even remember any of the titles anymore. It's been a long time since I read it. But the one with the, like, where they're exchanging those emails.
Oh, yeah.
That was the one that worked really well for me. Some of the rest, though, like, I remember the one about the bra fitter.
Oh, my gosh.
Just kind of like, what the heck? And then, of course, like, when in that story, she's married to this guy that's like an amazing bra fitter and like whatever. And of course, then she gets breast cancer and has to have a double mastectomy. And it's like that's kind of on the nose, you know? It's like, of course she does. Yeah. That's the only place you would go with that. So yeah,
a couple of the stories were, I mean, she was taking many modern situations and trying to fit the housewife into sort of like the modern, because when we think of housewife, you think 1960s America.
Yeah.
And she says that, you know, there are housewives in this day and age, and what are their problems or what things do they face? And of course, what things in American culture can I make fun of and draw into that? And so the one story that I thought was kind of funny was the dumpster diving with the stars.
Oh, yes.
The reality TV show spoof that she went into. And I thought, I did think that was amusing. And it was just like the overly dramatic, like so much reality TV is. And eventually, of course, like so much reality TV, you get to not sympathize with any of the characters by the end. You just want them all gone. And I thought
that what was weird about that one was that she used, was it John Lithgow?
I don't know.
Like an actual real celebrity.
Yeah, I don't remember. But yeah,
it was something
was
like that.
Weird.
Like John Lithgow. I think it was John Lithgow. And it was just like, I felt weird about that. Like, how do you get permission to do that? Like, I don't know. If I were John Lithgow, would I want to be in that
featured
short story?
In that way? Yeah. I don't know. And the story that I think really creeped me out the most was my novel is sponsored by Tampax.
Yeah.
That was the final story. And I think it was meant to be funny, but I just thought it was creepy. The amount of, I guess it's a warning, the amount of control that a sponsor could have over your novel or over your, you know, whatever you're doing that you need a multi-million dollar sponsor for. And took it as a warning to read your contracts before you sign. And I don't know. It was just so, all the stories to me, though, were just so over the top.
Yeah. No, they weren't over the top. They were just silly.
Yeah, well, no, that's kind of what I mean. It was like, it was just,
yeah,
the things that happened were just so out there. And I am not a real fan of satire. And part of the reason I picked the book was to try and broaden my horizons a bit. But really, none of the stories, the email one may be the exception, but because that was, I thought that worked for me, but none of the stories, none of the other stories really, like you say, I mean, there wasn't anything that I felt like I could relate to. The first story, I think, though, was an exception. It was sort of like, what is my day like as a housewife? And I'm so bored and unfulfilled. And I think in a lot of ways, a lot of people, housewife or not, in the first world, it's one of those first world problems where we are. Sure. We do have a sense of being on autopilot and of being bored and unfulfilled. And what can fill that void, I think, is what that story was talking about. So I think that one worked for me. It was pretty short. It was like only a couple of pages. But in terms of the humor in most of them, I kind of just didn't get it. And I'm glad it was short. That's all I'll say.
Yeah. I read it basically in a day. I finished it basically in a day, and I was like, okay, well, that was the thing I read. Mm-hmm. and I was ready to move on. And like, I wasn't, like I said, I wasn't sad that I read it, but I was just like, I was thinking about like, what were even the stories about?
I know.
It was weeks ago that I read it. I don't know. So, yeah, I think this was I don't even know that there's a whole lot that we can really unpack to discuss about it. It was just kind of like, these are some short stories, and they're satirical, and
really dark, and I mean, like, you know, in one of them, the lady cut up these people into pieces and froze them and then buried them, and, you know, I don't know that there's anything to really unpack. It was just kind of there, and I thought she had, like you said, good ideas, but they could be expressed in another way that would have appealed to more people, I guess.
Well, and it doesn't help that I think that, like, neither of us are American housewives. I mean, you might be closer than I am, but, like, you know, we both have day jobs.
Right.
And we are not, like, sitting there on our husband's salary being, like, you know, I am just so bored sitting there with all my husband's money.
Right.
That's not the world that either of us lives in. So,
right.
You know, and maybe if we were upper middle class white women that didn't have to work, we'd...
Yeah, maybe if we were, we would understand it better, but...
Yeah.
I don't know. Let's just move on. So, Christina, yeah. You were not the only one who found the book unsatisfying. And so you can feel better about that. And even we don't like the books we pick sometimes. So speaking of books we picked, what is our next book pick?
So our next book is, and this is another one that I'm not really sure about, but it's the opposite of this one because it is super long. Mm-hmm. We're reading A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. Okay. One that I feel like every time I say that name, I get more confident about how it's pronounced, and I still am not sure it's right.
Well, but we'll put a link to it in the show notes, so you'll be sure to find it.
Yes, it is about you know, this group of friends in New York, and I guess they suffer a lot. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's one of those things where I'm broadening my horizons because I'm really allergic to reading super dark books, but we're going to see how I do with 37 hours of. Oof.
If you say 37 book. Hours, people aren't going to want to read it. We shouldn't have said that. Oops, our bad.
Well, now you know.
But it is really long, and we'll see. I like dark books, but I don't like them if they are too long. So I get what you mean. We'll see how we do.
It's been one of those books that, like, people that I know have really used a lot of superlatives, you know, like, oh, I read this book and I was a mess for days, you know, that sort of thing. And it's when people say things like that, I'm just like,
and I have noticed a lot of people read the book and they thought it was wonderful despite being very dark. So I'm optimistic that if I read it, it'll work for me if I read it in maybe small snatches.
That's what I'm thinking too.
Mm-hmm. So that is our next book. And we have been discussing ways to encourage listener interaction on this podcast. Because, you know, when we get listener mail, it's like a thing to celebrate. And as the podcast is going over the hill, turning 40, we feel like we need to make a bit of an addition and change to the podcast. So We are going to have a question every podcast, and we encourage you to respond to the question by email or Twitter or on the podcast webpage. And the question for this month?
So, the question for this month, Erin, I'm just going to ask you, and we'll answer it for ourselves. So, we call ourselves the Book Hoarders Podcast because we hoard books. And I know that I have, like, millions of books that I haven't been reading, and I just keep collecting them. And, like, what... And I know you do too, but like, what are the ones that you just keep acquiring that you, like, you're going to read one day, but mm-hmm. you haven't done it yet?
Well, I can answer that. I have at least 2,000 books on my Bard wish list. I don't have a wish list for Audible, which is kind of strange, but I do for Bard. And of the 2,000 books that I have on my Bard wish list, a whole load of them are nonfiction, like, books about how to... They're like self-improvement books. And I keep telling myself, one day I'll read them. I've heard people say great things about them. And one day I'll read them and take their advice to heart and improve
myself. One day you'll
improve
yourself.
And one day I'll improve myself. And I have read a few of them. However... A lot of them are just sort of out there on my wish list. And, you know, like I said, that's one thing that I intend to do. I've read reviews of them, so I think they're worth being on the wish list. But whether I'll actually read them or not, I don't know. A couple of them I have started and abandoned. After
not ready for that much self-improvement.
Well, no, it's just that I felt like it did not need to be said in an eight-hour book. I thought that after I read 2 hours of the book, I sort of got the idea and didn't need to read anymore, and agreed and took the message to heart, and that was it. But I feel like those are the books that one day I'll get around to reading most of them. I tell myself that. What about you?
So I was thinking about this because actually we had a conversation on Twitter before the podcast started, where I was looking at my, I get these emails from bookbub.com that are about, like, you know, books that are on sale on Kindle. And, I tend to one click the buy button rather a lot. And I realized today that I bought a book. I can't remember what it's called, but it's a book about Guinevere. And I think that makes, like, the seventh or eighth, like, Arthurian legends mm-hmm. retelling that I have. And I read The Mists of Avalon when I was a teenager, and I keep meaning to read more and read other people's takes on it. And, I have a bunch of different ones, and I think I just get so intimidated by where to start. And then the other thing I was thinking about was that a few months ago... On this very podcast, you had read a book called, I believe it was called Star-Crossed by somebody named Rachel Higginson.
Oh my gosh, I can't even remember. Yes, I think you're right.
And I bought it. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I noticed, I was looking at her page on Smashwords, and she has written a lot of books.
Mm-hmm.
A lot. And I keep... Like, I haven't bought them all, but they occasionally go on sale on BookBub or, you know, one of those other sites. And I keep downloading them when they're free or 99 cents. And, just on the recommendation that you liked that one book that you read.
That I don't even remember.
That you don't even remember. So clearly you didn't love it that much. I just was like, one of these days, I really just need to read one of these, and then I can know whether I should keep buying the rest of these whenever I see them on sale. If you want to tell us about the books that you are hoarding, you can do that at bhapodcast@gmail.com, or you can go to our website at bhapodcast.com. Or you can tweet at us at Book Hoarders. That is our Twitter account. And we would love to hear what you're hoarding.
Exactly. And if you just want to tell us personally what you're hoarding, you can do that too. And we will make sure it gets in the podcast. If you want to tell me, you can tweet Erin Edgar on Twitter. And Shannon, you can find on Twitter at Bardsong, B-A-R-D-S-O-N-G. And we'd love to hear what you hoard as a book hoarder.
And if you want to listen to Erin on the Phoenix, she has the Melting Pot. It's back.
It's better back than ever. And better than ever for a while. And you can hear it tonight at midnight in the UK or 7 p.m. Eastern. That's another way of saying Sunday nights.
Sunday nights. We are not going to get this podcast out on Sunday.
No. You can hear it either on the Phoenix or Treehouse Radio because it is simulcast on both of those stations.
So when you get done with your readathoning next Saturday, go listen to the Melting Pot after you take a nap.
After you take a nap, you will be able to listen to the Melting Pot and, you know, request stuff and stuff. And are there any other things we should mention about you over the internet?
Not at the moment.
At the moment, okay. So, tell us what books you're hoarding. Read A Little Life by Hanya Nanagihara. And we will see you all next time here at the Book Hoarders.
All right. Have a great month, everybody.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
Springtime. Woohoo!
Yes!
Bye!
To contact the Book Hoarders, send email to bhapodcast@gmail.com. Follow Book Hoarders on Twitter. Call us at 520-81-BOOKS, 520-812-6657. And visit the website at bhapodcast.com.